papers of Singapore, he could see more police drones in the sky, their searchlights stabbing down. The search for him wasn't over yet. He started carefully stepping across the rocky, trash-strewn beach in his bare feet, following the junkies. As he proceeded, Durand saw a circular opening in the seawall ahead. He noticed the Chinese junkie glance back at him with concern before disappearing into the opening. Durand continued toward what soon resolved to a drainage tunnel, capped at its end by a series of galvanized steel bars bent to permit people to squeeze through. Around the edge of the opening, Durand could see broken motion sensors and proximity lights. The entire area had been wired for security at some point, but apparently that was just on paper now. He made a mental note to pass this intel along to the Singapore police force. As he peered into the darkness, Durand could see soft light in the tunnel ahead. He could also hear music thumping. Music. He moved cautiously forward and felt plastic crunching underfoot. Kneeling down, Durand could see bubble packs strewn across the sand in the moonlight. Drug printing. It made sense. He'd always wondered where in the hell on the island this happened. Drug smuggling was a thing of the past in most countries now, not because of any great advances in drug treatment or human nature, but because of synthetic biology. Just as algae, yeast, and bacteria were being custom designed to grow food, chemicals, and products, so too were they being harnessed to synthesize narcotics. No need to store or ship large quantities of drugs. No need to smuggle. Synthetic opioids, 100 times more powerful and pure than organic heroin, could be synthesized from a surprising list of mundane, common-use ingredients. All you needed was the right genetically designed organism, one that consumed sugar or iodine or any number of substances to produce a pure molecular narcotic. Nearly impossible to stop, nearly impossible to police, also far more deadly. And that's where the drug printers came in. Durand entered the tunnel and began moving toward a distant light. He stepped carefully to avoid cutting his feet on glass or rocks, crunching across trash. He passed alcoves where rail-thin shadows of people hovered, their crazed eyes catching a glint of reflected moonlight as they watched Durand pass. For a place to hide from the police, he could do worse than here. Invisible from the air, it already existed in defiance of the law, and in Singapore that was no mean feat. Durand was surprised he'd never heard a whisper about this place's existence. But then again, he wasn't really a cop, not like Michael was. It did seem odd that authorities would let a coastal industrial drainage tunnel go open and unmonitored. Wasn't there a risk of bioterrorists using this tunnel? As a data scientist, he was always shocked at how little of reality seemed to be modeled in the data. Internet of things be damned. This place shouldn't exist. And yet, here it was. After traveling 100 meters in darkness, Durand came to an intersection of 3 tunnels marked by bioluminescent light sticks. Green and blue and yellow light sticks formed an arrow leading down the center tunnel. The festive lights illuminated people rolling on the edge of darkness in the side passages. Shadows moaning, a grinning man with a bald head with wires inserted into drill holes at his temples leaned into the light, watching Durand pass. He laughed maniacally as he reached out to touch Durand. Durand batted the man's hands away. Off! Durand had heard of biohackers who electrically stimulated the pleasure center of their brain. Stim addicts, wireheads. They usually starved if the surgery was successful, for every one of them who'd suffered an unendurable loss that made them pursue the wire, there were others who were just pleasure addicts. Once the wire was in place, the motive made little difference. Durand moved deeper into the tunnel. The music grew louder. cacophonous, disjointed, and thudding. Laser lights flashed ahead. He soon entered a chamber 30 meters or so in diameter and 5 meters high, all smooth concrete. It was a junction for several tunnels radiating outward. Dozens of people languished in the preternatural twilight of light sticks, some trance dancing alone in their own worlds, others staring into space at the margins. No one seemed to be talking. A thin man wearing glowing lipstick approached Durand.
"Blowjob, baby?"
Durand shook his head, moving past into the crowd. He could see the dealers wearing LFP glasses, while the junkies carried cheap, flexible phablets. Gazing around in the semi-darkness, Durand saw glowing screens, actual physical screens. But it figured. After all, any junkie who'd had an expensive light field device had probably already sold it for drug money. Instead, all around him were cheap shit thin film screens, addicts laughing as they watched movies and TV shows, porn, played games. No photonics in here, he guessed, just old-school silicon. Durand passed along a line of dealers. As he watched, an emaciated junkie pointed out a tattoo of a molecular model on his left arm to a drug printer. The dealer scanned it under the bioluminescent light, and a moment later, the molecule appeared on a disposable phablet screen, ready for synthesis somewhere nearby. He'd never actually seen this in person, only read about it. Custom highs were the drug business now. Your drug was synthesized as you ordered it, specialized just for your DNA, to create the perfect high, to gauge the precise dose to avoid death, at maximum purity. Buyers had to have their genome analyzed only once, a free service from dealers, of course. Genomic analysis software could compute the perfect drug structures for that person. A tiny change to a molecule here or there went a long way, kicking the high up to the next level. And what better way for dealers to write down your preferences than on your own skin? Something that wasn't going to get pawned off or stolen when you were stoned out of your mind. Tattoos were forever. Another free service of the printers. Light flashed, and another drug printer scanned another tattoo. Within 10 or 15 minutes, the junkie could have a small hit of his choice drug produced somewhere in these tunnels and transported straight here by drone. It didn't take much to get high these days. Just a few milligrams would knock you on your ass for hours. Any more could kill you. But then, drug printers knew the precise dose their customers could handle. Big data had entered the black market, and the drug printers knew more about their customers than social media companies knew about theirs. The printers also knew dead customers weren't repeat customers. By now, some of the synth addicts had taken notice of Durand, backing away warily as Durand passed through. He still had bloodstains on his wet hospital gown, and looked like an escaped lunatic, even among the clientele here. Sofian Taniwan monitored his synth dealers with one eye and the Gujarat Lions cricket match with the other. He had serious money riding on both. The virtual screen created by his LFP glasses could have filled his vision, but as a pudgy, diminutive man, he needed to keep at least one wary eye out while inside the drain. The slang term for Singapore's underground drug printing market. The place certainly drained the detritus out of Singapore, human and otherwise. Taniwan raised his fist and stifled a shout as the inimitable McAllister shipped in with his 53rd run on the video inset, making the spread. Taniwan smiled briefly before erasing his emotion. It never paid to express emotion among the losers spiraling through the drain. Emotion was a tell, and tells could be exploited. But he had just won a substantial wager. Just then, Taniwan focused his left eye beyond his dealers onto a thuggish, thick-necked Eurasian man wearing, of all things, a hospital gown. He'd seen all types in the drain. people escaped from rehab clinics, the rich, the poor. But they had a gaunt, zombified look about them. You could see the hunger in their eyes. This man, though, looked like the opposite of a synth addict. In fact, he looked like trouble, and if anything had earned Taniwan the trust of his bosses, it was his nose for trouble. Taniwan reluctantly dismissed the virtual cricket screen with a gesture and focused both eyes on the man, who was now passing by his dealers with the gawping air of a tourist in the bad part of town. And yet somehow, this man looked like he brought the bad part of town with him wherever he went. Something was amiss here. What resembled bloodstains spattered the man's hospital smock. Taniwan was willing to bet it wasn't this man's blood either. Taniwan moved his hands with subtlety so as not to attract undue attention, bringing up his gang's facial recognition app. Like any business, they kept track of their customers, especially the troublemakers. This sort of thing could readily be misunderstood here in the drain. It was a poorly kept secret that the drug printing labs were tolerated by the SPF. They kept the synth addict problem out of the public eye, and no doubt greased a few palms as well. However, being a police informant was part of the deal. The positive match was almost immediate, and the man's virtual closed-eye 3D head scan and name soon rotated before Taniwan. Taniwan did not like what he saw. Not one bit. Marcus Demang Wicks, leader of the Huli Jing. Implicated in hundreds of murders, kidnappings, human trafficking, and just 2 hours ago personally murdering two Singapore police officers. Every damn cop in the city state was searching for this man. Taniwan wiped away the virtual bust of Wicks as though it was a letter from his ex-wife's attorney. True fear gripped him for the first time since he'd left the slums of Johor. Why hadn't he just minded his own damn business? Why did he have to spot this man? Now he knew. Normally, Taniwan would order his men to grab felons the police really wanted and, depending on the situation, dump the perp behind a police station, beaten to a pulp or dead. But that's what you did with unconnected nobodies. This was a different kettle of fish altogether. The leader of the Huli Jing had no doubt put out a call for his people, and they would be here soon enough. And so would the police. Some junkie was going to spot Wicks sooner or later, and a whole goddamned anti-terror squad would storm in here, the very last thing Taniwan wanted in the drain. It was bad for business. Getting into the feeds, increasing taxpayer awareness. No, 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 this would not do. But worse still would be the Huli Jing finding out that Taniwan had ordered his men to turn Wicks over to the police. This was a quandary. If he pretended he'd never seen Wicks, then the police could come storming into the drain any minute. If he turned Wicks in, then the Huli Jing would track Taniwan down and torture him to death on camera as a warning to others. But this was why Taniwan was in charge here. To make the tough calls. After a few moments' consideration, he decided to split the difference. He'd take action, but make sure no one knew the real reason. Plausible deniability. Taniwan glanced toward his dealers, where one of the Indo-Australian enforcers shoved away a dancing synth addict. Taniwan spoke to the man over a radio link.
Tuck. See that mental case in the hospital gown?
Taniwan watched Tok scan the crowd of addicts.
No, to your right, by the book pit.
Tok zeroed in on Wicks near the VR sex machines.
Got him. What you want? Take your mate and find out what hospital he escaped from and dump his ass back there. You having a piss? Just do it. Can we keep whatever we find on him? Sure, just get him the hell out of here. Crazy people are bad for business.
Durand moved past the printers, following lightsticks into the tunnels beyond and away from the crowd. There, he found more junkies and homeless. Durand stepped over legs and around makeshift cardboard shelters. As he walked, his shadow cast along the tunnel walls, but then he noticed other shadows behind his. Turning around, Durand could see two wiry-looking Southeast Asian men. They didn't look like addicts and wore faded digital camouflage military jackets in the cool air of the tunnels. No one else seemed to have jackets. Durand saw the glint of a knife catch the light as the men kept on his tail. Other addicts retreated into the shadows.
"Oi, mate!"
The lead one had an Australian accent. Durand turned to face them.
"You a mental case?"
The man's companion clattered across trash as he moved to flank Durand. A metal pipe slipped down into his hand from within his coat sleeve. Durand eyed them both warily. "I don't have anything. I just want to be left alone." Durand turned in place, arms extended, most likely revealing the crack of his ass at the back of the hospital gown.
"Yeah? Let's have a look at that wrist bracelet."
Durand noticed the hospital patient bracelet on his right wrist for the first time. "It's a printed bracelet."
"Could still work to get meds."
"Meds?" Durand looked at it and saw the name Marcus Wicks printed on it along with computer codes. He had literally been wearing a name tag this entire time. He tried to pull it off, but the material was tough.
"I'll cut it off, yeah?"
Durand felt anger rising in him. As if he hadn't had a bad enough day, now he was dealing with these two scavengers. They appeared well used to preying on loners.
"Don't seem interested in the printers, do you?"
The other one snorted.
"Doesn't look like an addict."
The first one nodded.
"Right. So, what you doing down here, mate?"
Durand studied both men. He was half a head taller than both.
"Looks like you got into one hell of a fight."
The other laughed.
"And lost."
"Right?"
The first chuckled as he rolled a curving, claw-like knife in his hand. Durand felt an unfamiliar calm again as adrenaline flowed. He felt focused, clear-headed. This was not how he usually felt in life-threatening situations.
"I just want to be left alone. I don't have anything."
"Let's see the bracelet, sweetheart."
He motioned with the knife.
"You turn around. Hands on your head, yeah?"
Durand shook his head slowly.
"We're not asking, mate."
They rushed Durand, the second man raising his foot-long pipe as he came in. Durand felt oddly detached from fear as he rushed toward the second man fast enough to get inside the arc of his swing. He grabbed the man's wrist and kneed him in the groin, then pulled him in front of the oncoming man with the knife. Durand twisted the pipe out of the second man's grip and pushed him toward his knife-wielding partner, who pulled back out of range as his friend collapsed, groaning in pain.
"You're proper fucked now, mate."
The first man lunged forward with the knife, slashing. Durand ducked back, raised the steel pipe, then hurled it at the man's face, connecting with a resounding crack. He followed it in. Durand rained haymakers to the man's head, stomach, and ribs. The knife fell to the ground as the guy collapsed. Durand grabbed the pipe from the floor of the tunnel and continued beating the man with it, a soggy, ringing sound echoing in the tunnel.
"Happy now?"
Durand panted heavily as he turned the man over, raising the pipe again. The sound of gasping and shoes sliding on concrete behind him. Durand turned to see the second scavenger trying to get to his feet. Durand raced after the man before he could even fully stand.
"No! No! Wait!"
Durand struck him in the stomach, then continued beating him until he collapsed, then still continued beating him.
"I just wanted to be left alone."
After a few more blows, Durand tossed the pipe to the ground, where it clattered and rolled across the tunnel floor. He stood, panting, and then turned around to see the eyes of gaunt addicts in the semi-darkness. He pointed at them.
If any of you fucking get near me, I won't be as kind.
The reflected light on those eyes disappeared, and he heard people pull farther into side tunnels. Durand caught his breath and looked down at the motionless bodies in the glow of light sticks. The men were crumpled and bloodied, but breathing. As his own pulse slowed, Durand could barely believe what he'd done. He'd just badly injured two men, beating them into unconsciousness. He'd been schooled in hand-to-hand combat at the Naval Academy, and he'd taken the odd karate and jiu-jitsu course, but it had always been theoretical up until now. He hadn't had a real hand-to-hand fight since high school, and never with an actual enemy. He examined his thick, bloodied hands. The tattoos had reappeared along his forearms. Then it occurred to him that there must be police informants all over the drug printing markets. How could he have been so stupid? Junkies were among the most pliant of informants. Soon this place might be crawling with police. He had to keep moving. He didn't have the luxury to dwell on this. He started rifling through the first man's overlarge camouflage jacket. He found a vape pen case and several blister packs with custom drug process codes on it. These he tossed aside. He heard the man groan. Durand pulled a cheap phablet from the guy's inside pocket, a thin film device. Common with drug users and low-level criminals. Prepaid. Solar-charged batteries. A couple millimeters thick, at least. In other words, obsolete crap. It would still be useful, but if either of these men spoke to police, they'd be able to track this device. Durand tossed it into the nearby puddle of water. What Durand needed most was clothes. He pulled the hospital gown off and dropped it at his feet. Feeling vulnerable in his nudity, Durand stripped the shapeless sweatpants and gray hoodie from the larger of the two men and put them on. He also slipped on the man's overlarge camouflage jacket. It was tight in the shoulders, but it would work. He then grabbed the second man's well-worn military boots. These were uncomfortably small, but they were infinitely better than bare feet. Now clothed, Durand searched amid the trash for the fallen knife. He saw it lying in a puddle of brackish water. Picking it up, he could see it was a grown knife. Probably a keratin-silica hybrid from some vat in Thailand or Vietnam. Highly illegal in Singapore. Non-metallic and thus difficult to detect on scanners. He squeezed the handle where it felt soft, and the blade retracted like a cat's claw into the handle. He squeezed it again, and the blade reappeared. It felt organic, like some hunter's souvenir from a big game hunt. He retracted the blade again, and stored the knife in his jacket. It was a felony to carry a concealed weapon in Singapore, but that was the least of his supposed crimes, and he guessed these men would have friends. Durand then rifled through the second man's pockets. He found another thin film phablet device, but also a dozen or more bit rings in a plastic pouch, probably stolen. These were disposable cryptocurrency devices popular with undocumented migrants, itinerants, and synth addicts. They served as wireless wallets for small amounts of digital money. They typically required physical contact between a terminal or another bitring to transfer funds, and were usually tethered to a parent device for loading money or setting up transactions. Bitrings were no safer than carrying cash, really, but were never loaded with much. It certainly beat connecting your main device to a potentially malware-infested point-of-sale terminal, and they were easily concealed by junkies. The only question was what type of currency was on them. There were a dozen popular blockchain cryptocurrencies now: ChaiCoin, TaiCoin, BioCoin, SinCoin, most linked to a central banking authority. cryptocurrency providers had concluded in the early 2020s that it was better to sell blockchain software solutions to central banks than to enter the heavily regulated banking industry on their own. More libertarian-minded flavors, like Biocoin, still existed, named because it used cell division and mutation inside a bioreactor as a calculation engine to unlock coins, while simultaneously generating intrinsically valuable biomass. But whatever money was on them should work. One of the men groaned again. Durand decided he'd figure the rings out later. Right now, Durand had to be anywhere but here. He headed off down the tunnels, moving past more homeless camps and dozing addicts clustered in twos and threes. Those awake watched him warily, but avoided his menacing stare. Durand collected several light sticks from the tunnel floor as he walked and held them up as a torch. Looking down a darkened side tunnel, he decided to follow it, going deeper into the maze beneath the city. He wondered how far the tunnels stretched. After walking several minutes, turning down occasional side tunnels, Durand spotted the glow of two phablet screens in the shadows ahead. He continued warily, and the glow suddenly disappeared. Durand put his hand on the knife in his pocket and held up the light sticks. "I know you're there. I don't want trouble. I'm just passing through." He proceeded, and soon he could see two outlines in the semi-darkness. Passing by them in the tunnel, he could see they were young Burmese or Thai men clad in cheap printed clothes, both of them thin and clearly nervous. One of them held a piece of steel rebar. Durand studied them. "Either of you speak English?" "Nihue shuo puto huang ma?" The men turned to each other uncertainly. Durand raised the bag containing the bit rings. "I want to buy one of those phablets." He pointed at the phablet still in one man's hand. "I'll pay. Wo hui fu." The man on the left said simply,
"How much?"
Durand reached into the bag and fished out a bit ring at random. He tossed it over. The man caught the bit ring warily and then touched it to the one he wore. He then consulted his phablet screen. He shook his head.
"No good. Much more."
Durand tossed another one. "That's what I've got." It wasn't, but he hoped it was enough. The man checked this ring like the first, then looked at his companion. Both seemed either pleased or offended. It was hard to tell which. The second man nodded. He tossed the cheap phablet over to Durand, who caught it without dropping the light sticks.
"You go now."
The man raised the rebar menacingly. Durand nodded and continued down the tunnel, glancing behind him to see that the glow of their remaining phablet had returned. He also thought he could hear gleeful laughter. Okay, maybe they got a deal. But he got what he needed, too. Access to the net. After 20 minutes of walking and taking several more turns, Durand entered a small chamber that bore evidence of past human habitation. Plastic tarps, spent light sticks, excrement, and trash. But nothing recent from the look of it. A small pool of brackish water occupied the center of the chamber. Small drainage pipes fed into the room from two walls, but the tunnel continued through the far wall. He had a means of escape if someone came from either direction. Durand tossed the light sticks onto the floor and then dropped onto a fiber pallet next to the pool of dirty water. He felt his exhaustion coming on him in waves. He caught sight of a stranger's face reflected in the puddle's surface next to him. He gasped and reached for the knife, but then stopped. It was his own reflection again. The surreal nature of his situation hit home. The Eurasian face staring back at him was bruised, square-jawed and thick-necked, his bald head scratched and cut, his dark brown eyes intense. Who was this? Was it really Wicks? Durand felt more bereft than he had ever felt. Even worse than the night his father died back when he was in high school. And he had to grow up so suddenly. No, this, he didn't even know what this sensation was. Utter loss. The death of himself. How was this possible? It seemed like just last night that he'd been reading to Mia. But that was weeks ago now. The magnitude of all he'd lost became clear. Mourning gripped Durand. Examining his own thick-fingered hands again, he began to weep. Everywhere he turned made him feel more lost. Could he even convince his wife and child who he was? How could he ever get back? Durand wept for an unknown time, teetering on the edge of insanity as he gazed at the bruised and beaten stranger in the water's surface. There was no getting back. Images of his wife and daughter came to his mind, but they now soothed him. They would know him. He was sure of it. He could convince them. And then, something occurred to Durand. He was still himself. His mind was unchanged. His body and face might have changed, but he was still himself inside. So his brain hadn't been altered. Was it the blood-brain barrier? This comforted him. There was a limit to the transformation. Durand took a deep, calming breath, then looked down into the pool of water at the stranger's reflection. The analyst inside him wondered, how was it done? And more importantly, why was it done? Someone had somehow edited his genomic sequence, trillions of living cells, each edited in hundreds of ways. CRISPR edits on an unimaginable scale. Edits on an embryo were one thing, but edits to a living, complex organism? This was light years different. The human body had evolved over millions of years to resist invaders. Attempts to change DNA, say by a viral infection, were quickly detected by RNA within the body, the invaders destroyed. If a virus somehow managed to make edits, these wouldn't match the DNA template in the cell's nucleus. And if enough changes occurred, the cell would effectively commit suicide in a last-ditch effort to protect the rest of the organism. No, humans and life in general had evolved serious genetic security. That's what made biology so robust as a manufacturing platform. If you tried to break it, it resisted. So how had they done it? Durand examined his bruised arms and neck. He recalled that when he awoke, the doctor said the swelling had only just receded, that he had whole body swelling and bruising while he was in the coma. His body trying to fight something off. Edits. His body must have been trying to resist massive, contemporaneous edits. Dear God. Someone had really figured it out. They'd figured out how to edit the living. Durand sat back and contemplated this. If that was true, and he had firsthand evidence that it was, then it had major implications, not just for Durand, but for all of humanity. For the future of life on Earth. Anything could be changed now. By comparison, embryo edits were child's play. Durand looked closer at his reflection in the water. Even the bones of his face and jaw had changed. He opened his mouth. His teeth had been slightly altered as well. DNA was the cornerstone of criminal forensics, of legal identity itself. If you couldn't rely on DNA staying the same, how could you hold anyone responsible for anything? It suddenly dawned on Durand. That's why Wix did this. Durand pulled the cheap phablet from his coat pocket and searched public news feeds. Durant saw his new face all over the headlines. The top item on the Straits Times described the Singapore police force's massive manhunt aimed toward preventing Marcus Wicks from escaping Singapore. Durand quickly found the Interpol red notice, too. There he was, the man reflected in the water's surface. The Huli Jing had literally made Durand into the criminal he was hunting. Durand recalled Marcotte's briefing, how arrests and turnover of Huli Jing ringleaders had no effect on the cartel's rapid expansion. He lowered the phablet in sudden realization. The nine tails of the Huli Jing weren't dying. They were changing their DNA, perhaps killing someone else in their place. Then a startling idea occurred to Durand. If the Huli Jing could edit him once, they could do it again. Couldn't they? If they changed his DNA, then they could probably change him back. Durand caught his breath. There still might be a way to get back to his family, back to his life. Durand's mind raced despite his exhaustion. He looked at the stranger's reflection in the water. He nodded, and the stranger nodded back. The Huli Jing could change me back. However, it would require one critical component he was currently missing. Some of his original DNA. A slight grin creased the stranger's mouth. He knew just where he could get that. Chapter 13. Detective Inspector Ayana Marcotte approached heavily armed Singapore police tactical units guarding a sub-basement corridor. The masked sentry there noted her Interpol ID with suspicion, but nodded her through. She walked toward bright lights and evidence technicians, 3D scanning the scene of two dead policemen in a blood-spattered elevator car. Several Singapore police detectives conferred nearby. Hospital attendants waited with gurneys, since the scene was just down the hall from the hospital morgue. Detective Sergeant Michael Yiji Chang stood beyond the yellow police tape and saw her approach. "Evening, Inspector." Marcotte stopped alongside. "I had planned on congratulating you for locating Marcus Wicks." "You still can," he grimaced, "though he got away again." She nodded toward the scene. "I'm told the Singapore police had 24 men managing the transfer." "I personally watched them chain Wicks hand and foot." He pointed at the unlocked cuffs still wrapped around the rails of a toppled gurney. "Have they found the gun?" "No. No idea how he got one either. Probably a polymer piece, maybe printed here in the hospital. They're checking printer logs." Yi shook his head. "I had Wicks. I should have just stayed with him." "Then you'd be dead too. If I'm not mistaken, you have no gun." Yi said nothing. "Too bad we don't have police powers here." Marcotte studied the scene. "It's pretty clear Wicks had inside help." "I'd agree with you, except their street camera imagery of Wicks fleeing alone, barefoot and bare-assed, looking confused and afraid." Marcotte pointed. "Elevator security camera cut out during the escape." Yi considered this news. "I hadn't heard that." "And one of the police drones was taken off station at a crucial moment due to some mysterious malfunction, giving Wicks a blind spot to escape into." Yi looked around and spoke softly. "You really think Wicks had inside help?" "I think the Huli Jing is a multi-billion-dollar transnational criminal organization with eyes and people all over."
"But you think people inside the SPF helped?"
"I don't know. But I do know the Huli Jing crossed a line on this one. The rest of the SPF is on the warpath. As we speak, they're raiding every Huli Jing safe house, bordello, and lab on the island looking for Wicks." Yi grunted. Suddenly, the SPF has actionable information. I think even the crooked cops are with us on this one. Wicks can't murder SPF without consequences. They'll tear apart Huli Jing operations until the gang coughs him up.
Nice to have their full cooperation.
They stood for a moment in silence.
I read Inspector Bellinger's report on your initial interview with Wicks.
Yi just stared.
That Wicks claimed he was really Kenneth Durand.
Yi remained stone-faced.
None of it made sense.
That Wicks knew personal information about you, her? That he knew classified information about the GCD? Yi hesitated before responding.
It was uncanny. That's the only word for it. He knew things. He knew...
Yi paused.
It wasn't just that, Inspector. He had Ken's mannerisms. You know what I mean? I used to do a wicked impression of Ken, to make fun, like you do. But this guy, he had Ken down cold.
Marcotte studied Yi's expression. And then he killed two cops and fled on foot. Yi deflated.
Okay, maybe part of me wanted to believe him. Like I said, none of it makes sense.
For the record, Sergeant, what he claimed isn't possible with any known technology. Yi looked at her sideways.
So you checked into it?
Didn't have to look far. Yi hissed.
When I saw that DNA match for Wicks, I thought, they buck, this is my chance to find Ken.
Inspector Bellinger says you haven't given up the search for Agent Durand.
I'm not an idiot. I know Ken's dead. I know. But I still need to find him. I owe him that.
He searched for words.
Have you ever heard of the concept of Han, Inspector?
She shook her head.
We Koreans have been invaded and tossed around by forces beyond our control for centuries. It's built in us a feeling of resentment about our helplessness, a desire to strike back against any injustice, no matter how futile it might seem.
That's Han? He nodded.
And we Koreans all have it. I will find Ken. I won't rest until I do.
She studied him for several moments.
You knew him how long?
Since before Interpol, Coalition Forces, Africa. We were bug hunters together.
Biological weapons, like the one released in Paris.
Yi nodded.
Clearly there were failures. Ken usually blamed himself.
Is that why he left the service?
He met Miyuki, saw a future worth living. Miyuki and Mia were everything to Ken.
Yi's expression clouded.
Sergeant, I've asked Inspector Bellinger to loan you to me.
Yi looked up.
I know you want to locate your partner, and I respect that. But frankly, you're no use to the Genetic Crime Division in your current state. However, you did locate Marcus Wicks once. I'd like you to help me find him again.
The determination on Yi's face was obvious.
That's convenient, because I was planning on doing that anyway.
Where do you suggest we begin?
By trying to find out what Wicks was doing here in Singapore.
Chapter 14. What Otto liked most about the capital was its lack of humanity. Its buildings were empty monuments, more akin to a mausoleum than a city. From inside the autonomous Tesla Model L limousine, he watched through blacked-out, bulletproof windows as the sanitized streets passed by. The sprawling, ultra-modern metropolis glittered in the sunlight, boasting 16-lane boulevards and gargantuan, outlandish architecture, each building separated by wide, ornamental parks. All of the pathways and park benches devoid of people. Robotic landscaping machinery roamed here and there, trimming hedges and lawns, cleaning windows, sweeping streets, tending flower beds. No cafes or bodegas, no shops, no billboards or logos, no pedestrians, a planned cityscape utterly bereft of human beings. It was a marvelous achievement. Otto noticed his own reflection in the window glass. Somewhat Slavic this month, perhaps Russian-Mongolian extraction. Last month, he had appeared more Southeast Asian than Mongolian. The genetic engineers could tell him his current genetic mix, but in truth, it didn't interest him. He smiled an alien smile. Whoever this face belonged to did not matter. Change itself defined Otto now. His only immutable feature, gray eyes, anchored him, helped him know his own reflection. Eyes, after all, were the windows to the soul. The Tesla rolled to a stop beneath the marble portico of a 50-story building hundreds of meters from its nearest neighbor. The tower had organometallic lights bright enough to trace its outline, even in daytime. The gullwing limo door rose automatically. Otto emerged into the sunlight. He wore a well-tailored gray suit, his pastel pink double Windsor knot, as always, perfect. He might not choose his face, but he carefully chose his wardrobe. Otto mounted wide marble steps atop which stood uniformed, heavily armed soldiers of indeterminate Central Asian nationality and ethnicity. They bore no insignias or unit patches on their randomized, digitally printed urban camouflage uniforms. Were they Kazakh, Turkmen, Mongolian? It was difficult to know. As he reached the top of the steps, a canine patrol passed on its circuit of the building. Two vicious mastiffs snarled and strained against their master's leashes. But as they drew near Otto, the dogs raised their ears, drew back, and then whimpered before straining with all their might to flee. Soon the soldiers were shouting commands as the dogs pulled free and fled in terror into the wide, empty street, yelping like puppies. The feeling was mutual as far as Otto was concerned. Animals were simply more honest than humans. The entire line of soldiers avoided Otto's gaze, and glass doors hissed open to admit him into a high-ceilinged lobby hung with ornate crystal chandeliers. The world's gaudiest golden-mirrored service robot vacuumed rich red carpets that were trimmed in gold tassels. Otto trailed his hand affectionately over the robot's polished surface as he passed by. He had a soft spot for robots. They weren't as off-putting as humans. He entered an elevator car paneled in mahogany, crystal, and brass. Without his selecting a floor, its doors closed and whisked him to the penthouse. There, Otto exited, walking between grim security men in blue suits bulging from gel body armor. The final two guards stood before closed oak doors, richly carved with Asian dragon motifs. The guard on the left, a 6'8" bearded mountain of a man, held his hand up to stop Otto.
"He's in a private meeting, Mr. Otto. He asked not to be disturbed."
Otto let a crooked smile crease his face. He then walked right up to the guard while the man's colleague gazed nervously elsewhere. Otto held out his hand as if to shake.
"And who are you?"
Uncertain, the first guard extended his own massive hand. Otto swiftly clasped the guard's hand, watching closely as a sheen of sweat appeared almost immediately on the guard's face. Seconds later, a dark wet stain spread from the guard's crotch, urine dripping onto his dress shoes. The man pulled free from Otto's grip and backed away from the door, and then away from Otto entirely. Existential dread was written on his face. He gasped for air.
I'm sorry. Please.
The other guards swung the doors open without a word, still avoiding Otto's gaze. Otto calmly entered the penthouse office. It had a sweeping view of the unpopulated city below. The double doors closed behind him. He heard voices to his right and turned to see an Indian bioengineer in a white lab coat speaking to the owner of the office, who stood with his back turned inside a large, ornately fashioned conservatory. The enclosure was alive with fluttering silver, black, white, and orange butterflies and was easily 20 feet wide. It contained potted trees, a fountain, and flowers. Otto would recognize Marcus Wicks anywhere by his commanding presence. He didn't need to see the man's face. In fact, Wicks's face, like Otto's, was forever changing. But Wicks's presence never changed. And it was why this human was the closest thing to a father that Otto would ever have. Otto approached silently. The researcher spoke haltingly to Wicks.
We did as instructed, prepared a lethal change agent, a revision to your birth DNA.
Wicks observed a silver, gold, and black butterfly crawl across the back of his hand as he replied with an Australian accent.
I didn't instruct you to include my chromatophores. Now this man apparently has my unique mark of rank. He's already displayed it in public.
The bioengineer stammered.
We have never performed a lethal transformation outside this facility, Master Wicks. And it has never been raised as an issue before.
Wicks's voice remained calm. Was I born with chromatophores?
No, of course you were not, Master Wicks. But I assumed you wanted him to be mistaken for you.
After he was dead. Not before he was dead.
But, Master Wicks, the added processing to remove chromatophores would have been...
As Otto quietly came alongside the researcher, the man drew back as if he sensed something wrong nearby. The butterflies within the conservatory suddenly took flight en masse, fluttering from the back of Wicks's hand. Every one of them clustered at the farthest point from Otto that they could manage. Wicks spoke without turning.
Otto.
He turned and smiled, revealing a mix of Slavic and Chinese features, ruddy-faced with short black hair. He wore a cashmere sweater and tailored slacks.
Humanity's last hope has returned.
Otto smiled slightly. Wicks nodded to the researcher.
Leave us.
The man happily complied, clearly eager to get away from Otto. Otto opened the conservatory door for Wicks. They did not touch as Wicks exited, but Wicks smiled warmly before moving toward a massive mahogany desk a dozen meters away near the tall bank of windows. The desk was carved with Chinese dragon motifs and entirely out of keeping with the modern architecture of the office.
I'm glad you're back so soon.
Otto's voice was measured, calm.
Our new partners were very cooperative.
Well, that's fortunate, because a problem has come up that requires your unique talents.
Wicks sat in an ancient-looking leather wing chair. Otto sat in one of the two modern guest chairs in front of the desk, unbuttoning his suit jacket.
Do you recall administering a very important injection for me in Singapore last month? Into the Interpol agent responsible for locating so many of our partner labs.
Otto considered the question for a moment, then nodded.
Yes, in a crowded train station, I recall.
Wicks nodded.
Yes. The dose was meant to be a lethal change agent to transform the man into someone very special.
Me.
Otto contemplated the event.
That was uncomfortable, being around so many humans.
Wicks's expression softened.
You know how much I appreciate your sacrifices, Otto. Our research would not be possible without you.
Has there been a complication?
Yes. Unfortunately, the target did not perish after the transformation completed. He survived. And what's worse, he's now running around loose. Otto pondered this news.
As you?
Wicks shrugged. As what I once was. At least partially so. And worse still, he's got this. With that, a full complement of green, blue, black, and orange tattoos faded into existence on Wicks's neck, forearms, and knuckles. Within seconds, they stood out in vibrant color. From a mild-seeming businessman, he now had the appearance of an arch-yakuza or triad warlord. As if by reflex, Otto's chromatophores responded in kind. He saw his own Hulijing tattoos surface on his hands, but knew they were activated across his chest, back, arms, neck, and legs, too. They both had unique patterns, their own signature. Otto nodded.
Your marks of rank. That is a problem.
Wicks nodded back. Yes, it's a problem. One I need you to resolve. He made several hand gestures, and a desk-mounted LFP beamed virtual images into Otto's retinas. Internet news feeds floated before Otto. One headline read, "Cartel Kingpin Kills Officers in Dramatic Escape," with a scan of police boots sticking out of an elevator door. The other article showed an Interpol red notice and photo of a bald, fierce-looking man that in no way resembled the Marcus Wicks sitting in front of him. That headline read, "Infamous Gangster Loose in Singapore." Wicks nodded toward the images.
I'm not sure how he did it, but this Interpol agent is now on the run. Our friends in the police failed to do their job.
Will they find him?
We can no longer rely on the police, but the media should make it easier to locate this person. His face, that is, my old face, is all over the news. I'm now wanted in nearly 200 countries. It'll be difficult for him to hide.
Wicks passed the virtual Interpol red notice to Otto, who examined the image carefully.
I want you to do what the police could not. Find this imposter, kill him, and leave his body where it'll be quickly found by the authorities. It's high time for Marcus Temang Wicks to finally die, and his lengthy criminal record along with him.
Otto nodded.
It also eliminates our most troublesome enemy. There is a beautiful symmetry to your plan. I will see it done.
Good.
Wicks smiled, closing his eyes in relief.
I knew I could count on you, Otto. You know there is no one I trust more in this entire doomed world than you.
Otto stood, and with a nod, he headed for the elevator. Chapter 15. The junkie's phablet was cheap, Tanzanian-made shit, and Kenneth Durand wasn't used to tapping at a physical screen as he walked. AR light field displays were a much more natural way to interact with information. But then, non-retinal displays had huge advantages to criminals, which Durand now technically was. They couldn't easily rat you out. Durand had been walking for several kilometers down a long drainage channel, headed northward. Holding up the phablet screen and comparing his location to a city map, he turned down the next side tunnel and edged around motion sensors, lowering his head as he passed a camera. These, too, appeared to be out of commission. It was obvious that the criminal element moving about the tunnel system beneath the city regularly broke the devices and sabotaged locked entry gates, although the locks were disguised to appear intact. Durand was surprised the SPF tolerated this.
He remembered all the security data being fed into his systems from Singapore officials, and he wondered to what degree any of it was true. He found it hard to believe that Singapore would tolerate malfunctioning motion sensors and bent gates in a drainage channel going out to the strait, allowing passage by random people unchecked.
How could they permit junkies and transients to wander across the city unobserved via the drainage channels?
He wondered if this was a state of affairs Michael Yi would recognize. Had the SPF relegated security to informers among the junkie population? Had they come to terms with criminal gangs to keep an eye out for terrorists moving through? Human intelligence was something street cops infinitely preferred to IoT data. Durand was starting to realize they might have a point. He passed by a couple of Filipino teens strutting to Thai retro funk. The music echoed confidently in the tunnel, but the young men turned their music down and moved warily around Durand on the far side of the tunnel as he glared at them. They looked petrified. Urban explorers, future synth addicts. Difficult to say.